Happy New Year. My name is Terry Igo, the CEO of the Sanibel Captiva Trust Company and its affiliates, the Naples Trust Company and the Tampa Bay Trust Company. On behalf of our founder, Al Hanser, and myself, and all our employees, we want to wish you a very safe 2021, and please know that we're here for you and your family. Should you need anything, please give us a call. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning and welcome to the first public asset management committee call of the new year. My name is Ian Bruch, Chief Investment Officer. Thank you as always for joining us. Today is January 7th. And as always, I am joined by our broader team of portfolio managers, which includes Tim Vick here in our Naples market. And in Tampa, we have Andrew Vanderhorst and Brianna McDougall joining us. And out on Sanibel, as always, we have Ed Siskowski, Gary Dyer, Craig Holston, and Joel Johnson. Information presented is for educational purposes only. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. And you can visit our website for full disclosures. Well, welcome again. And before I get into the content of this call, I did just want to make a few announcements. Now that we're here in the new year, we're going to be making a few slight tweaks to this program in the new year. The first major change is we're going to be moving this weekly call back to a monthly call. So this next call will be on February 4th. We're doing that for a few reasons. One, we instituted these weekly calls at the beginning of the pandemic just to be closer in communication with our clients and friends of the company. Now that we're obviously improving on that front. Markets are less volatile. We have the elections behind us. Probably less of a need of a weekly call, but also we're really looking forward to the enhancements we're going to be making on these monthly calls going forward. I think you're going to see some additional functionality on this virtual environment with some additional charts and graphs to back up the content that we're speaking to. And we're also probably going to incorporate some video so you can actually see our faces on these calls going forward. So, stay tuned, but I think you're going to be pleased with the enhancements that we're making to these monthly public forums going forward. And again, if there are friends, family members, neighbors that you think would appreciate being a part of this, we would welcome the opportunity to send them an invitation. So please reach out to us and let us know. I would also just like to mention that before the next call, which is February 4th, the week of January 18th, we're going to be hosting our virtual annual outlooks. These are presentations historically we've given in our various markets live in front of people together in a normal world. We're going to be holding these virtually, obviously, in the midst of we're still obviously dealing with COVID. But please join us for those. If you have not already received an invitation for the week of January 18th, let us know and we'll make sure an invitation is sent to you for those. But we're looking forward to that as well. That'll be a little bit longer program. We'll be reviewing 2020, talking about our expectations going forward as well. Now, with that said, let's get into the content of today's call. Most notably, I think this week, obviously, was the Georgia runoff elections where John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock won their respective Georgia Senate runoff races that occurred just a couple of days ago. And what that means is the Democrats and the Republicans now each have 50 seats in the Senate, which gives the tie-breaking vote to Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, which really does give control of the House, Senate, and presidency to the Democrats. So I know that was of interest to many, many people over the last few months. We now have some resolution on that. I think what's nice to see is the markets have largely taken this news in stride. And I just think it's a good reminder. We get on these calls and talk about how politics don't matter as much to capital market investing as we like to think sometimes. We conflate the two issues more often than not. And I think we're seeing in real time that money can be made under different administrations, regardless of how you feel about them. And I see that as frankly good news. I'm pleased that we don't have to rely on politicians for portfolios to perform well. And I think we're seeing that in real time. The market's largely taken this news in stride, which is good. A Congress also this week officially certified President-elect Biden's Electoral College win. That actually happened earlier this morning after what was already expected to be a contentious process on Wednesday was really derailed by protesters that stormed the Capitol. I'm sure everyone saw that news yesterday. In the wake of the certification, I think it's notable that President Trump finally, promised a peaceful transfer of power. In a statement that was shared through the Twitter account of a senior aide, Trump said that, even though I totally disagree with the outcome of the election and the facts bear me out, nevertheless, there will be an orderly transition on January 20th. So again, markets do like certainty. And I think the fact that we're putting some of the political discourse behind us now as we head into 2021 is frankly good news. Now, from a coronavirus COVID standpoint, we last updated these numbers before the end of the year. Not much has changed here since about a month ago. Here in the United States, the seven-day moving average growth rate of COVID was a little over 1%. I think the last time we reported on that number, it was about 1.3%. So we're still getting around 200,000 new cases every day over the past week or so. Not much has changed on that front. But, you know, we're not getting that exponential growth in new cases that we were getting back in the month of November, which is marginally good news. But let's all just remind ourselves, we're seeing caseloads increase across pretty much every state right now, as well as the percentage of positivity. So of the tests being done, the numbers coming back that are positive is also increasing. Testing is also up in many states. So even though we have vaccines in circulation, obviously, and that's terrific news, we still all need to be mindful that we're still in this right now for the next few months at least. Hospitalization data continues to be stressed in certain areas of the country. That's probably the more worrisome trend here near term. And then, you know, at this point, I think capital markets have largely ignored what I think is the slower than expected initial vaccine rollout, really in favor of broader optimism surrounding just the vaccine development itself. So, you know, I do think, though, you know, with a seemingly one-way economic and earnings growth recovery narrative so dependent on widespread inoculation by the end of the first half of this 2021 year, you know, I think it should be expected to remain an area of scrutiny for the market. You know, we are heading into 2021 with some pretty optimistic expectations for what sales and earnings growth are going to be. And I do think the vaccine rollout is going to be important to helping us achieve those expectations. So more to come on that, but we're going to be watching that closely, obviously. Outside of that, on other economic news, it's been pretty light over the holiday weeks, but additional stimulus was obviously passed since we last held this public call. Stimulus checks have gone out or are going out in addition to other spending portions of the bill. And, you know, regardless of your political leaning, let's just all acknowledge that additional spending is frankly good for the stock market returns, just like lower interest rates are accommodative. They're good for stock market returns. Additional spending is also gives an extra tailwind to the markets, so to speak. This morning, initial unemployment claims were released this morning. Those came in at 787,000 versus 800,000 last week. That's also fairly consistent to the numbers that we were sharing late last year. It's really been a pretty consistent range. And I would just like to remind everyone that that's still a really high level of initial unemployment claims on a historic level. Back in the crisis of 2008, 2009, I think the highest initial claims we were reaching were in the 600,000 range. So on a weekly basis, we're still at a range that's higher than that. Just continues to show that labor markets are going to continue to be choppy here. It's not going to be a smooth move higher to lower unemployment levels. We are on the cusp of another earnings season. So by when February 4th comes around for our next public call, I think we're going to have a pretty rich program in terms of both the economic news, and we'll also have some company specific news to share with you at that time. And with that said, I'm going to toss it over to Tim Vick, who's going to give us a quick summary of 2020. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Ian, and Happy New Year to everybody. We're always so happy you chose to join us again this morning. We just finished what I think was one of the most memorable years, at least in my career in investing, and certainly one of the most surprising markets any of us have witnessed. And I'm sure a lot of you are wiping your foreheads in relief that stock prices finally recovered all their early 2020 losses. And many other investors are pleased to see not only that did the market recover all the declines, but actually pushed to record highs to finish the year. And all this was occurring while the economy was posting its worst, fastest slump in history, then rebounding, then stalling again by year's end. And stocks actually displayed more volatility in 2020 than at any time since 2009. And the wide range of returns we saw from well-known stocks and from certain asset classes was frankly incredible. I'll give you some examples. You know, stocks like Amazon, PayPal, and Apple, they rose more than 75% last year, 75% in a recession. Walt Disney rose 25% while it was experiencing one of its worst declines in profits in two decades. Nike and Microsoft rose about 40%. Home Depot, Lowe's, Costco, they rose 20 to 35% each. Again, this is all during a recession. Now, a handful of stocks like these, in fact, accounted for nearly all the gains in the S&P 500 last year. And another way of looking at it was that you could have stripped out the returns of several large technology stocks and a few retailers like Home Depot and Nike, and the entire rest of the stock market provided close to zero returns last year, zero. That's what made the market challenging last year. I mean, the S&P finished the year up almost 18% if you include dividends, but the average stock didn't come close to providing an 18% return. And the average stock still trades about 10% off its 52-week high. A handful of the largest stocks provided more than 40% returns, while dozens provided flat to negative returns, and the average of them turned out positive. Now, to give more examples, real estate stocks fell more than 15% on average. Stocks of major oil companies fell 30 to 50%. And large banks saw their shares fell from 10% to, in the case of Wells Fargo, more than 40%. Companies like Boeing finished the year down 34%. General Electric spent most of 2020 down more than 50% until it started rebounding in the fourth quarter. And then, of course, you had cruise line stocks and hotel stocks. Many of them fell more than 40%, you know, through the year. And in the middle of all this were hundreds of normally defensive stocks, drug companies, consumer staples, utilities. They finished the year with just modest gains and returns varying from plus 10% to minus 10%. So by year's end, the S&P 500 provided a pretty strong double-digit return, and only twice in the past 40 years, and not since 2009, in fact, had the market fallen so much during the year yet finished so strong. And this, of course, reflects the unique nature of the recession we were experiencing. The recession started abruptly, with the coordinated actions of local governments to shut businesses, and it ended abruptly when businesses began to reopen. Sales and earnings started rebounding sharply in the third and fourth quarters, and stock prices followed. But as I alluded, the gains were very spread out. What we call momentum stocks rose 30% last year, cyclical stocks rose 28%, and small cap stocks rose an average of 20% last year, all very strong gains in any type of environment. And meanwhile, the defensive stocks, like I said, the types that traditionally do best in a recession, they returned just 5% last year, while high dividend paying stocks returned just 2%. And so-called value stocks returned zero. I personally can't recall a time when defensive stocks like this perform so poorly in a recession. They typically perform the best. But the COVID recession was as unique as we've ever seen. Now, around the world, stock markets likewise finished positive, but they were influenced mostly by the weightings within their indexes. Chinese stocks led the world with a 30% return last year, and that was owing to the fact that China dealt with COVID the earliest and the quickest, and its economy rebounded the quickest as well. But if you ignore China, U.S. stocks really were the place to be last year. Our returns were well ahead of Japan, Europe, and most of the rest of the world, where returns were averaging about 11% last year. In the U.S., we're fortunate that our stock indexes are skewed toward growth, and they're skewed and most heavily weighted to the two industries that proved to be immune to the COVID recession, that is technology and healthcare. In Europe, by contrast, their largest companies are highly cyclical banks and insurance companies, oil companies, and auto manufacturers. They really have no Amazons, Googles, or Apples to boost their economy or prop up returns during a recession. And that's a key difference to keep in mind when you're looking for investment ideas, you know, across the Atlantic. But if we take a step back from all this data, we did see a few trends that were worth noting. I mean, the first most surprising unpredicted price move we saw in 2020, I think, related to bonds. Very few people forecasted that U.S. government bond yields would drop in 2020 from 2% to well below 1%. A huge move that boosted substantially the price of all bonds, but it certainly helped inflate asset values around the world. Corporate bonds returned 10% last year, and that was a very strong performance given recession worries. Treasury bonds returned on average 8%, high yield bonds returned 7%, and municipals returned about 5%. Now, in terms of valuation levels, of course, they're getting distorted by the performance of the few technology stocks that I mentioned earlier. The top 10 largest stocks in the S&P 500 ended the year trading at more than 33 times their expected 2021 earnings. But the other 490 stocks in the S&P 500 traded at a more reasonable 20 times forward earnings. Many of these 490 stocks are cyclical companies whose earnings could rebound surprisingly well next year, and that can make their valuations even more attractive. You know, to us, there are still plenty of opportunities to go shopping in the stock market and yet fly around the lofty valuations that are getting all the media attention right now. You know, another trend we saw was that asset prices were mostly rational in 2020. That is, the divergent wild price swings we saw, they closely reflected the turmoil that companies were going through. Stocks and asset classes that fell the most seemed to reflect the countries and the industries that were worst hit by COVID. And assets that rose the most were in industries that not only were not affected by COVID, but actually benefited, like online retailers, social media, shipping companies, information technology, biotech, and internet security. And when we parse the returns of individual stocks in 2020 in retrospect, we can make sense of most of the price swings last year. I said most of the price swings of Tesla, Snowflake, and Bitcoin are still beyond our comprehension right now. But when we step back, we have to note that every year is unique in the financial markets, and every year was unpredictable when it started. There is no such thing as an average year in the stock market where every stock and asset class performs exactly as expected and provides that nice equal 7% or 8% return. I mean, a year ago, we saw the potential for the stock market to rise more than 10% in 2020, but we could not have foreseen the roller coaster ride that produced the double-digit returns we eventually got. You know, finally, I would note that the stock market's like golf. The leaderboard changes frequently in financial markets, round by round, tournament by tournament, year by year. Last year's best performing asset classes sometimes become the worst performing asset classes within months, and vice versa. So to us, making bets on the stock market now simply by throwing money at what worked last year, sometimes that results in mediocre results going forward. So having said that, we're entering a new year with optimism and fresh eyes, and with a range of valuation levels to review. Some asset classes now don't look so appealing to us, while others appeal to us even more. It's going to be an exciting year for us. So anyway, thanks for your time this morning, and I'll turn it back over to you now.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah, 2020 was obviously a unique year for many reasons. I think that was a good summary of much of what we saw. So thanks for that. Gary, I'm going to send it over to you to provide a quick fixed income or bond update. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian, and good morning, everyone. While the stock market certainly had considerable volatility in 2020, the fixed income market was really no different. Due to the COVID pandemic, the Fed intervention in the debt market to normalize those rates and ease investor concerns, the 10-year Treasury had the largest calendar year change in 5 years. As Tim mentioned, the 10-year yield dropped from 1.9% at the beginning of 2020 to 0.9% at the end of the year. However, you may remember the 10-year dropped all the way down to 0.5% during the summer, and then it doubled in the second half of the year. Now, when you look at the futures market and how it projects the 10-year Treasury and where it predicts it will end at the end of 2021, It thinks it will be about 1.1%, which is a move of less than 20 basis points. Now, short-term interest rates are forecasted to change even less, with the one-year note at a yield of about 9.9 basis points as of 12/31/20 and projected to increase to only 13 basis points on 12/31/21. Now, if you look at it from a Fed funds rate perspective, every Fed governor continues to expect the target rate to be kept around the zero bound in 2021, and the five of the six sitting governors forecast that there will be no need to hike the rate in 2022. Now, one of the questions that we get all the time is, why do yields not reflect the growing debt level? In other words, the U.S. government is borrowing an ever-increasing amount of money, and why doesn't the growing debt level have an impact on yields? Well, the main reason is that relative to other countries, the 10-year Treasury has an attractive yield versus these countries, even though those countries are considered less creditworthy as the U.S. For example, the 91 basis point yield at the end of the year on the 10-year U.S. Treasury is compared to 55 basis points for the 10-year Italian sovereign debt, only 2 basis points for a 10-year Japanese note, and minus 37 basis points for the 10-year French note. Now, one last item that I think investors should keep an eye on is how this low interest rate environment is impacting consumer purchasing power. So despite the pandemic, core CPI inflation rose about 1.7% in 2020. Now, while this figure is relatively tame, when you compare that to the 10-year Treasury of less than 1%, the real yield was negative. In other words, consumers lost purchasing power last year as the cost of products rose faster than an investor could earn if they invested in the 10-year Treasury. So while the current spread between interest and the inflation rate is unusually upside down, if you will, it would certainly be a positive for the economy if it reverts back to the norm of that positive real yield. So I'm going to turn it back to you, Ian.
Great. Thank you, Gary. Much appreciated. Ed, I'm going to send it over to you. I think you've got a company we've been looking at. You wanted to just discuss? Thanks.
Sure, Ian. Thanks, and Happy New Year to everybody. The company in question is a company called Fidelity National Information Systems. The ticker is FIS. It's commonly called FIS. And FIS is a leading provider of core technology solutions to various merchants, banks, buy-side, sell-side brokerage firms, private equity firms, et cetera. The company is in the process of merging with WorldPay, an acquisition it made, and that acquisition's about 2 years ahead of time in terms of synergizing it. This acquisition will have the effect of accelerating the top line, the revenues from say 3-4% to hopefully something in the 6 or 7% range, as well as accelerating the bottom line from a low teens grower to maybe a mid-teens grower. Basically, it's a faster revenue and more profitable business. Fidelity reports in three segments, a merchant solution, a banking solution, and a capital market solution. On the merchant solution side, and this is global, they serve merchants by enabling the acceptance of electronic payment, credit, debit, prepaid payments, originated physically or contactless cards, mobile wallets, card-not-present payments in e-com situations, et cetera. They provide the processing, authorization, settlement, customer service, chargeback, et cetera. And then they provide, you know, value-added services such as security, fraud prevention, and then various data analytics. The banking segment, again, provides core technology solutions, basically the core operating system of a bank. So it's lending, it's deposit gathering, and all the various items that might be associated with either of those two activities. They also provide fraud, risk management, compliance solutions, electronic funds transfer, et cetera, for wealth and retirement solutions as well. They have some really kind of cool apps in terms of speed of processing, ease of use, et cetera, that banks often prefer than having in-house. Probably the only bank of size that I'm aware of that does all their technology themselves is JP Morgan. Pretty much everybody else outsources it. And Fizz is one of the players here, along with Fiserv, Jack Henry, et cetera. The final piece of their business is a capital markets piece. And this is a piece that provides services to the buy side client, the sell side client, private equity firms, et cetera. This is mission critical record keeping, data analytics, trading information, risk management, et cetera. They continue to make acquisitions and investments to modernize platforms. These are very sticky businesses. Once you have a core operating system in a bank, it's very difficult to displace that technology simply because it's expensive, it's time consuming, and it's fraught with, you know, potential risks. So these tend to be very good, high recurring revenue businesses. We think Fizz is an excellent tech stock that doesn't trade at tech multiples, and it's one that we continue to keep an eye on, and we'll report on it on a go-forward basis accordingly. Back to you, Ian.
Thank you, Ed, for that summary. Much appreciated. That brings us to the end of today's call. We thank you all again for joining us, and again, keep an eye out for an invitation to next month's public asset management call, which will be on February 4th, and of course, our upcoming annual Outlook events, which will also be virtual the week of January 18th. Thank you so much again for joining us. Have a good rest of your week, and again, Happy New Year.